This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Welcome to Shaken and Disturbed, everybody. I am so excited. I think this might be my first time I'm taking this solo. So I've got my big girl panties on. Very excited. Okay. I'm friends with this next person. I've cultivated a relationship with this person. I've spent time with this person. I have intellectually reached into her brain and grabbed so many amazing things that I just had to have her on the podcast because I truly couldn't think of a better person to have on the podcast. So let me please introduce, without further ado, Sarah Azari, who is a lawyer. And that's all you kind of need to know right now. She's a lawyer because she's going to introduce herself better than I ever could. But we are friends, right, Sarah? I think I can confidently say that.
You're a new friend that I love and adore. We worked on a project and I talked with you because I thought, how reasonable is this person? Innocence and presumption. I was like, okay, go ahead with your bad self. So yes. We're very good friends.
Yes. You were like sort of in this project without giving too much away. I was kind of the lay person. I was the dum-dum, the person who doesn't understand all the legal ease, just the person who has an interesting hunch, who cares about justice, who cares about criminal justice reform, who was a big advocate, as we sort of talked about the Innocence Project, which we're going to get into today. And you were the know-it-all. I mean, you kind of had all your facts and your figures. So can you give us a little background on how you got started as a lawyer, why you wanted to become a lawyer, just like a quick little, and then obviously mention your podcast as well.
So I'm a criminal trial attorney based in LA, but of course I travel wherever my case takes me. And I say, you know, I do both street crime and the bougie crime. So I do everything from, you know, robberies and homicides and rapes and sex crimes to white collar stuff. And so with the federal work, obviously I go wherever the case takes me. I've also been a media legal analyst for about 16 or so years. Well, I've just been hustling, girl, you know, girl. So I've been on all the stations.
Yeah, you've been on everything.
Used to all of it. And you really are one of the gifts in my career in media, because it's really refreshing to see that people question things, and especially when it comes to my space, which is crime, you know, and criminal defense. And, you know, the idea that you're not automatically jumping on the guilt wagon and saying, well, if the guy's arrested, he's definitely guilty. And it was so refreshing to hear your passion about this that, you know, I thought, wow, well, so there is a podcast that actually in the truth, you know?
Yeah.
So it's an honor to join you. And, you know, I got started because, you know, your girlfriend is Persian. So those immigrants,
yes,
those of us who are immigrants, there were expectations posed on us. If we came to America, you got to be like a doctor,
lawyer, an engineer.
Yeah, right. And so I was like, I was about to go to fashion school. I'm like, what? Lawyer, what? Doctor, what? So it was sort of by default that I thought, well, I'm the one that's always questioning things. I'm always arguing. I'm always, you know, for
me.
So I felt like that's probably I'm more drawn to law school. And then how I got into criminal defense was just, I was like millions of Americans fascinated with crime. And I was, a lot of my friends were getting in trouble in college and law school. So I was like, all right, I guess that, you know, that's where I'm headed. But that's how I fell into this. So
Can I just a few questions? Well, first off, I want you to talk about your podcast, The Presumption, because, you know, that is obviously a big, I think, just for the layperson, for people reading headlines off of CNN or just fucking Twitter, for fuck's sake. I think people automatically, when they read a headline, boy slain, weirdo was next door to him checking him out, you're like, that dude's fucking guilty. I mean, that dude's fucking guilty, without really knowing any of the facts. So what is The Presumption about? How long have you been doing it? And what's kind of the goal of that podcast?
So The Presumption is, I love the name, because the presumption of innocence is at the heart of the standard of proof, which is entirely on the prosecution, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it's something that we've like completely forgotten about as a society. You know, no one's presumed innocent. In a court of law, you're not presumed innocent, even though
Crazy.
The Constitution requires that. And in a court of public opinion, we cancel everybody. So clearly you don't have that there either. And, you know, how it came about was... I was following the Murdoch trial, the Alec Murdoch trial, very closely,
yeah,
and connected with his lawyer, one of his lawyers, Jim Griffin. And after the trial, he was so bummed, obviously, about the outcome. And I believe that he was wrongfully convicted. And so I was sort of not commiserating, but I was just kind of, you know, trying to make him feel better about what happened and why it happened and all that. And he was very interested in having or creating a platform that was balanced out that guilt heavy sort of side of media. And so that's how the idea came about. And we, you know, we try to be weekly, casually, sometimes we're not because we're busy with our law practices, but it really, we try to show that other side that matters, you know.
That's what we try and do in Shaken and Disturbed. And by the way, smash that subscribe button. I never know which side it's at. I know you're on YouTube too, so I always just use the raising of the roof. But if you're watching on YouTube or on our Patreon right now, I like that. Obviously, I'm not a, we sort of talked about this offline, and I've certainly talked about this with Shaken and Disturbed people and people who come into contact with me, that I'm a big proponent of the Innocence Project. I feel like, at least for our listeners, I kind of brought that into the forefront. And you know, there are sort of reasonable opinions, I think, on both sides. I think it is something where I think reasonable people can disagree without being disagreeable. Like if my brother or my family member was killed, every emotion in me would want that person to die. And so I do kind of understand that. I'm not trying to make a judgment call, but for me, I do fully believe that I would rather have a guilty person go free if the evidence doesn't prove that they are guilty, rather than certainly an innocent person have to sit in prison. I just think that that's probably the worst thing ever. And, you know, one thing I say to my Persian girlfriend sometimes when we're watching these true crime docs is like, even with Alec Murdaugh, who I, just for the look of him, I thought looked guilty, you know, the beady eyes, the hair, you know, I mean, I was one of the big people that just be like, he seems guilty, is like in court, it doesn't really matter what the truth is. It just matters what you can prove. Is right. that right?
You know what you show, you know, that's why right. I say what you show. And sometimes you're not able to show everything, both sides, because of the rules of evidence. I know we're going to get into that later, but
yeah,
you know, the admissibility of the facts really depend on the rules of evidence, but really the judge, you know, he can control the trial based on what he allows or keeps out. And so, yeah, theoretically, you know, it's about the truth coming before the jury, but sometimes it doesn't, you know, and sometimes even if it does, just one or two facts that you may have thought are not such a big deal end up completely changing the jury's mind to where no truth will change their mind the other way, you know? And,
yeah.
And the case we're going to talk about today has a little bit of that going on.
I mean, certainly the most probably prominent example I can think of off the top of my mind would be O.J. Simpson, how if Rodney King had not happened so close to when it happened and why it happened, I think the jury would have been a little bit more prone to probably see the facts as they were, rather than he's a black man, let's make him innocent because we want to get payback because Rodney King was killed violently. So I think set and setting also obviously does matter. Before we get into Scott Peterson's case, which I want to talk to you about, one thing I'm always kind of just because you're a lawyer, and maybe this is just too vague of a question, what is the advantage or disadvantage of having a trial for the judge deciding or a jury deciding? Like, why would I not want a jury, or why would I want a jury?
Such a good question. We never go with the judge because often judges are, except for district court judges, federal judges, state judges, you know, the judges that sit on murder trials, for example, don't have their seat for life. You know, they are appointed for a term. And so I hate to say it, but they don't want to lose their seat. And so, you know, even former public defenders that become judges sort of go to the extreme of, it's just the system. They become part of the system, and you've got one arbiter versus 12. And so, you know, the 12, they have to reach a decision unanimously.
Yeah. Right.
And one guy. So the risk is just horrendous, right? And it's really interesting because several years back, I had a rape trial in my guy was an Air Force guy. And so it was in the base, and I'd never done anything like that. And so I was like, oh, why does everyone have these like cute little sexy jackets and berets? And like, I'm here in like my civilian peasant outfit.
What a Persian thing to say. What a Persian, to be concerned about your outfit on a base. I love that.
Stood out like a sore thumb. Everyone was all like, anyway, I told my client, I was like, if I win, which I did, will you try to hook me up with one of these like uniforms? But, you know, hilarious. It was interesting because the military trials, you often do go with the judge. That judge is there forever. He has seen real war crimes. Like, he will not tolerate bullshit and lies and concocted stories and stuff. And so I remember being horrified. I was talking to different people who'd done it, and they said, oh, just go with the judge. This guy, oh my God, go with him alone. Do not ask for judge. I was like, what are you talking about? How could I just go with one voter? You know, like, right. This is to me. And really, that's the only time I've ever opted for a judge. Unless, of course, the proceedings, there are some proceedings where you don't get a jury, you know, like administrative court or sometimes juvenile cases, you don't have a jury. And so in those matters, like, you have no choice. But if there's a choice, we always go to the jury.
Interesting. I kind of never knew that. I could kind of guess that you'd probably want more diverse opinion. Obviously, could get 12 people to unanimously agree on something feels like a big undertaking, as we saw in 12 Angry Men. I mean, all it takes is one person to kind of dissent from that, and they get to kind of walk free, which you'd want.
That's a win for us. Right. A hung jury is just as good as a not guilty, depending on the hang, right? The proportion of the votes, because often, you know, if it's so close, they won't refile and they won't retry. So, you know, for us, it's just as big of a victory.
So you're here today because, you know, we were actually, I think, together when it broke or something about the Innocence Project, which is, you know, I give some money to, taking on Scott Peterson's case. And we were with other people who were also in this criminal true crime space, people who were intellectually curious about this. And as far as I remember it, I remember you and I probably being the only two in the room to be like, IP is not taken on anybody that they don't feel is a good case. They're not just doing charity work. They're taking it on to prove a point that there's a lot of innocent fucking people sitting in prison right now with no good evidence. They wouldn't have taken on Scott Peterson's case, such a high profile case, just to lose it. That wouldn't be in the best interest of IP. So let's discuss a little bit about Scott Peterson, because it's been about two decades since he's been convicted. He's been sort of sitting in prison, how they originally convicted him. Because from what I know and what I seem to remember, I was obviously a lot younger. To me, what I can kind of remember is they just sort of convicted on him being a bad, shitty husband, which does not a murderer make. He obviously had an affair with somebody, but that would be literally like 90% of the population then would be murderers if we're just going on affairs and being shitty husbands or wives. So talk to me a little bit, if you can give a little background on Scott Peterson and what you remember and why he was convicted and if you thought the evidence was sound then.
Well, first, let me talk to you about the affair. I always thought that this was about the affair and stuff.
Amber Fry, right.
But I recently found out that apparently they had sex only four times.
That's correct.
It doesn't make her a side chick. It makes her a booty call in my book.
Right. It makes a you up text. That's what it is.
I'm sorry. Booty call does not rise to the level of motive. And so what happened was, you know, I mean, you know, you don't like want to your wife dead because you're just having sex casually like four times with this person, right? So, I mean, it's just not that plausible. And so, and it wasn't. And so what I found, and I'll get back to, I'll go back to how I, my interest in the case, but
yeah, please.
But on this affair thing, it was really interesting because it really, one of the biggest reasons why Scott Peterson was convicted was not just because he was a cheating, lying husband, because when the prosecution put on that evidence and they thought they were just like, they got the motive down, the jury was like, you know, you kind of like read the jury and they're kind of like, nah, okay, or whatever, like, not right. Really. But what happened was the tapes, the Amber tapes, you know, those were so damning, Darren, because she went to the police and she, you know, she felt like Scott was lying to her. It was a typical side chick thing.
Sure.
And went to the police and the police said, oh, we want you to record him. And so Scott on those tapes was lying about who Lacey was.
And she could legally record him. It just needed one-sided consent. Is that how that works?
She started working for the cops. So it was part of the investigation.
Got it. Okay. And then, and you can freely use those recordings no matter what.
So okay. The cops, you know, we're now using you, essentially you're cooperating with us and you know, you're going to record them. And so when those tapes were played, that is where this case took a turn because for a long time, and I got this from his attorney, Pat Harris, the papers, the local papers were like, oh my God, I think the prosecution is just going to dismiss this case. This is not going well for them. And then suddenly it took a turn. And it was because the jury heard him on these tapes. It's one thing for someone to testify about like a relationship or whatever, but this was like, they heard him giggling and you know, your wife's gone missing, right? He's giggling. He's like, you know, lying about who Lacey is and was and what happened. I mean, it just was terrible. That's really to a large part what I think the verdict was attributed to, but also the fact of what things did not come before the jury. So to me, it wasn't almost like about what everything that they heard and saw, but what was missing, you know? And so I remember the trial. It was a long ass
yeah.
Night trial. And I remember that the defense kept making every single day. They were saying, objection, objection. We don't have this discovery. We don't have this report. This person's testifying about X. We never got it. Where is it? The judge would then scold the prosecution. It was like daily. The judge would then yell at them and say, you've got to turn it over. I mean, it was like a huge big deal that there was stuff not turned over. I never in my wildest imagination would have thought that these were exculpatory things not turned over. And I thought, well, if the trial's going to, it's just going, I imagine.
Isn't that required by law, though, to present the present either side with whoever doing the evidence with exculpatory information?
Yes, it's a Brady violation. And if evidence has even the possibility of being exculpatory, it has to be timely disclosed. And not only they didn't do that, remember this was a death penalty case. They
right.
got the penalty on Scott. He was later resentenced. But so imagine not disclosing evidence that goes to the penalty phase. It was insane. And so there were, as it turns out, and this is why the Innocence Project is involved, there were leads that they did not follow. There were witnesses whose statements they did not produce. There was investigation that they didn't tap into. And actually on that topic, another reason why I think Scott was convicted was because the defense was not allowed to introduce evidence of the burglary. Their theme or their theory of the defense was that Lacey was a very sort of outgoing kind of confrontational person. She would just run up to whoever was doing whatever wrong and be like, yo, what are you doing? You know, she's like that kind of busybody in the neighborhood.
Well, the Karen of the neighborhood, but maybe in a good way.
Definitely the Karen of the neighborhood.
Sure.
That she ran up to these burglars and that was the beginning of the end of her.
So there was a burglary that happened across the street from the Peterson residence the night of her supposed disappearance or around the same time?
I think it was the night before from what
okay.
I remember. Okay. Very close to the time. And there were two vans, because the theory was that the burglars rolled up in bicycles. They were taking a big ass safe out of this house. They couldn't take it on a bicycle. So yeah. They called up.
Doesn't seem smart.
Yeah. They called up a buddy who came with a van. And then there was a second van that was seen. So there were two vans at issue. When the defense asked for to basically go and inspect the van, they were not allowed to do that because it was deemed irrelevant.
Who gets to deem it irrelevant? Wouldn't the defense get to deem that irrelevant?
No, the trial judge. So there'll be pretrial motions about discovery motions also, but also pretrial motions about, things they want admitted, things they want excluded. And so this judge decided, we are not going to blame this on a burglary that occurred across the street.
But you're not blaming it on that. You're just exploring whether or not there's to be blame, right? I mean, you're just presenting a possibility of what could have happened. You're not saying that this is definitely tied. I want the right to explore this as a possibility of the reason she's murdered or disappeared or whatever the hell it was at this point.
As a doubt, right. And so the judge said, no, this is not coming. So because of that, I imagine they didn't get to inspect the van. When they asked for photos, and we always ask for color photos, right? And often we get black and white. They ultimately never turned over color photos of a mattress that was in one of these vans that had apparently a stain on it. Turns out to be a blood stain, but a blood stain, you can't tell it's a blood stain in a black.
Why do you get them in black and white?
Because they just do it in the office as opposed to like having a professional color copier or having the law enforcement officers who are assigned to the case take it to.
I love that a person's life truly can be determined because they are just too lazy to hit color on a print option or too cheap. I mean, that seems.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Absolutely absurd.
I still receive things on CDs and I'm like, but I don't have a CD drive.
Right.
And know anybody that does and
right.
Look at this evidence, like with my client, like they don't care. They just, so anyway, it was really crazy because the defense was not able to, that was a huge theory that it was the burglars that were behind Lacey's disappearance. They couldn't bring any evidence of that in. And when people criticize the Innocence Project, I have a real problem with it.
Me too.
Because they don't have, there's no like written like guideline that there's just like headquarters and they all have to adhere to these guidelines when they vet a case or take.
Well, I was going to say, to give you a little bit of clout here, you volunteered at the Loyola Innocence Project. I believe you said that, right?
Yes. And, okay. I was not involved in the intake or the vetting, but I know.
But the barrier to entry, you would probably know why they'd take on a case or not. I mean, even as a layperson, I'm like, they ain't fucking taking on a high profile case that they don't think that they can prove. That would make them look even shittier.
No. And by the way, they have to believe two main things. So, IPs are not run by like a central, organization, although they sort of formed sort of a national kind of camaraderie or organization. They're not bound by any sort of template, set of rules, but they really do sort of have similar guidelines. And the main thing with anyone taking on a post-conviction matter is that you believe, based on information gathered, newly discovered information, that the person was wrongfully convicted. In other words, they're innocent, legally innocent, right?
Right. It doesn't matter what they actually did. All that matters is what you can prove in court. That's it.
They did not get due process and right. Sixth Amendment protections. They did not get a fair trial. They were wrongfully convicted. And you can prove that because the burden shifts to the defendant. It's not like a trial where the burden's on the prosecution. Now the defendant has to prove that they were wrongfully convicted. And so if you can check those two boxes, you're not doing anything shady or wrong. You are doing what you're supposed to be doing as a lawyer, is making sure that someone's conviction was not through cheating and failing to disclose evidence. By the way, did you know, Darren, that the DA, one of the DAs in Scott Peterson's case, was sleeping with the lead investigator, the law enforcement officer? And people think like that's just some.
How is that not important to the guy? I mean, like, they're not going to do a mattress, they're doing black and white photos, but they're not going to mention this? Yeah. This feels like a major conflict of interest here.
Yes. And it's also a, it is law enforcement supposed to be completely neutral, and they're sleeping with the DA whose career is this case. This is a little county. You're not going to get that many Scott Peterson cases out of this county, you know? And so she's literally like, this is her major kudos in her career. Right. And you're sleeping with her. Like, and I mean, how's that not? There was a murder conviction out of Kentucky, I believe, that got turned out. I mean, kicked out because of that same reason. So it's not a nothing burger fact. There was DNA that stain on the mattress that was never tested or sampled, which could come back to Lacey. There was DNA that was tested, but there's been so many advances in DNA testing that the Innocence Project is also asking for retesting of some of the items because they don't believe that the results would necessarily be the same. There are new witnesses that have come forward, including an inmate who made a jail call to some friend or relative, I think maybe his cousin, speaking about what he knew happened to Lacey. I mean, these are like direct recipient witnesses. So, you know, I'm sorry. I think that there's a lot here that supports the Innocence Project's decision to take this on, far beyond even like, well, this is a really high profile case. We better make sure our shit's in order. They really do have a lot to back this up with. And so I think we'll see how it goes, but.
Well, because the IP takes on cases we probably never even heard of, people who've been rotting in jail for 45 fucking years. So if they're going to take on this high profile case, something that's really going to put them on the map, not everyone knows what the Innocence Project is. Unfortunately, I think it started to get a little bit more and more and more. And I think with Scott Peterson, this is going to kind of, for better or for worse, people are going to know what the IP is. I seem to remember, again, this was 20 years ago and I was a lot younger and I didn't really have my intellectual mind then. But what I seem to remember is, A, there was no there was no murder weapon. There was nothing that they could actually tie to Scott putting his hands around Lacey, bludgeoning her to death, whatever the fuck it was, whatever they were going to kill her. All that I seem to remember is like he went out fishing with like cement blocks and people were like, oh, yeah, she's... He killed her. And I was like, he went out fishing? Like, I don't see why that's that big of a deal. Do you remember that sort of detail in the case and why that seemed to be a linchpin?
They also said he was fishing and it was too cold for fishing or some crap like that. It was too cold for fishing. Apparently, he didn't even go fishing. He went to move the boat or some shit. It wasn't even fishing. But for whatever reason, they came up with fishing and it was too cold. And then he dyed his hair. Well, he dyed his hair because I don't know about you, but when I was in junior high and I couldn't afford to get these highlights, I would go to the CVS or
Sunin. You get Sunin, yeah.
Buy that shit and put the shit in my hair myself and then think it's cute. Well, Scott Peterson did that and then went in the pool and the chlorine turned it into that horrific color. It wasn't like he went and dyed it that color. It just turned out like that. And he really is whole motive behind that was because media was harassing him, following him around.
Shit.
And he was just like, leave me the fuck alone. I'm this blonde guy. I'm not Scott Peterson. He wasn't like escaping or
he just wanted to like go to maybe the grocery store without everyone calling him maybe a murderer for 2 seconds, which I think we all kind of get that light. I mean, the truth is if social media was around when this actual case came down, I don't even know how much worse it would be. I don't even know if Scott would be alive, like in truth. But one of the things we always talk about on Shaken and Disturbed in our old podcast, Martinis and Murder, actually was brought up when we first discussed Scott Peterson, because there was a fact that we read that when he was in the back of the cop car, you know, the cops were like, do you want anything to eat? He was like, yeah, I want a double from In-N-Out. And everyone was like, how could this man want In-N-Out after killing his wife? How could this man want this? And I was like, facts aren't feelings. Feelings aren't really facts. Like we all have different reactions to traumas in our life, dyeing our hair, wanting In-N-Out, going on a run, escaping our environment. Like people do this every day with drugs and alcohol. So I don't know why it would be shocking when we do it with something traumatic, but the public really like really latches on to these like behaviors as if they're proof of something. And they just aren't proof of anything. I mean, if I surveyed 10 people off the street right now and gave them a situation, I'm not sure any one of them would react the exact same way. It's a feeling. It's not a fact.
Remember when Brian Koberger was
the Idaho murderer, the Idaho college campus murderer? Yes.
But actually, now I'm thinking about it. Every single time he comes into court,
he's scary a little bit.
One's a fucking behavior analyst. Everyone. Right. Everyone is a profiler.
He blinked twice. He's clearly lying when you ask him a question. I was like, or he had dust in his eye, or sometimes I blink more, or I have a spasm in my eye. Like, that can't be the only reason we're putting people in prison.
Last part, the best, and this is very common, is when they say, oh, when he got arrested, you know, an innocent person would be screaming and saying, I didn't do it. He didn't do that. So he's guilty. And I'm like, oh my God. Like,
or he's shock, or he's in just complete fucking shock and he can't say anything because
he's a criminal justice student and he knows to keep his fucking mouth shut. How about that?
You know, it's even when you're not in trial, I mean, how many cases have we heard of domestic violence where the woman has the opportunity to escape and she goes back to her abusive husband? I'm using sort of a generic example. This happens all the time. She goes back to her generic husband. The husband beats her again, but apologizes, you know, and people are looking at her being like, I would never go back. And I'm like, you actually don't know what you do because there's so much childhood trauma built in this. There's just layers of trauma that people are able to react differently. It's like people treat people in groups as opposed to individuals. And that's not every white 35-year-old lesbian woman is going to react the same way that I would just because you're also 35 and white and gay. Just like my girlfriend's not going to react the same way you would because she's Persian. I mean, that sort of feels almost ridiculous. And yet this is what the public sort of holds on to. And my other point to you is like, well, I can understand people thinking Scott is guilty, especially now after 20 years, that almost feels, you know, open and shut. I don't think anyone thought the IP was going to take it on. Why do you think the public gets so fucking upset if they want to retry him? I mean, wouldn't the truth be truth regardless of guilt or innocence? I mean, if they think he's guilty, he'll be retried again and found guilty, and then we can all put this to bed. Why are people so hesitant about retrying people?
Yeah, it's such a good question because, again, that happened with Murdoch too, you know?
Right.
I think the media and the larger part of the population, especially those who are fascinated, you know, with crime, they just cannot see it any other way than through the lens of guilt and the narrative of guilt. It's negative. It's just, I don't know. We are obsessed with negative. We really are. And nothing can change their mind. You know, we, you know, in the Murdoch case, for example, when he came really close to getting a new trial granted because of the jury tampering, because he was really close. And the judge just didn't want to go there, but people were losing their shit. I was getting death threats just because of my analysis.
That's insane. I mean, that's insane.
And I think once we attach to a certain narrative, we detach from the legal process and the truth within the courtroom, even, you know, the rules, all that goes down the toilet, you know?
Yeah.
We don't even care if we're wrong. You know, we just, this is the outcome I wanted. And this, it has to remain that way. And it's really something. And I think, I don't know. I think we're that way, you know, in the whole cancel culture thing too. You know, cancellation, you know, this really well from your work in reality TV, but you know, we lean towards cancellation. We don't want to give anyone a chance. And then we don't ever want to see a comeback. Like, what happened to the good old America?
A redemption story, whatever happened to that? Or learning, whatever happened to that?
Yeah.
I also kind of wonder if Lacey wasn't pregnant, would this case be different? And if the genders were reversed, if Scott was murdered and Lacey was at home having the four-time fuck fest affair and went fishing with her family or was laughing and giggling with this guy in the background, would we feel the same way? I feel like it's so easy to think like, nah, the guy's a jerk. He fucking murdered her and she's pregnant. He's a dick. He just didn't want to be a dad. Then it would be if we reverse the genders.
It's very true in that respect.
A lot of bias that goes into these things, in our opinion.
I think the bias definitely still, I mean, it's misogyny too. Yeah, it's bias. It's misogyny. It's that we are a culture where, we're looking at him as the bad guy because he's the cheater. I'm not sure we look at her as a bad person if she was the cheater.
Right.
You know, double standard.
We'd be like, she needed to get away from that as opposed to, you know, he's just a philanderer. You know, you talked about in the presumption an evidentiary ruling, and you kind of mentioned this up top. Is that just like anything that the defense or prosecution thinks could be evidence they present to this judge? And then the judge is like, yes, no, like, why can't something be presented as evidence? And don't you think if it's just based on that judge, there could be a lot of corruption with that? I mean, he could have his deep pockets in with somebody else. And that doesn't feel very fair that it would just be kind of up to one person to be like, yeah, fuck the burnt van. That doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, right?
He's like the referee, you know? So, but that really impacts the whole game. And so it's an important, like, look, as lawyers, we are sort of governed by the code of evidence, but there are exceptions, you know, to all the rules. And the two principal rules are relevance and, in other words, evidence that is relevant to prove a fact should be admissible, right? And so what is relevant, that definition is up to the judge if it becomes a question of, you know, if the other side fights it. If the other side agrees over it, then there's no problem. The second biggest issue is that evidence cannot be more prejudicial than probative. So maybe it is relevant, maybe it is going to prove a fact, but the prejudice to a jury to see it or hear it is so great that it's not worth the evidentiary value of it. And again, that's another determination made by the judge. And then, of course, you have all the hearsay rules of evidence where something's hearsay doesn't come in except if it falls under a hearsay exception. But evidentiary rulings are so important because they really change the trajectory of a trial. I mean, just like in Peterson, I'm not sure if Scott would be convicted. Maybe those Amber tapes were so, so bad that nothing could, you know, change the jury's mind. But I'm not sure if they were able to see that how the defense was tying in a burglary and evidence of this burglary. I don't know that 12 people would vote for guilt, because remember, they were allowed to argue it, but you can argue whatever you want. They weren't right. Able to give the jury the evidence of the burglary. And that's huge, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's make or break. I mean, you could say that he's having an four-time affair with Amber Fry, but until you hear him giggling in the background, it might not really sink in, you know? Yeah. And wouldn't it matter if one of those jurors maybe had a cheating husband and wanted to get back at her cheating husband through Scott Peterson? I mean, that's kind of what we saw in the O.J. Simpson trial with a bunch of people being pissed about Rodney King. I mean, they said it in the ESPN doc when they were interviewing some jurors. We're like, it probably would have been different had Rodney King not happened. This was our payback as a race, as a culture, for the violence that had sort of happened. I mean, if you had jurors and women on there who had just been pregnant and had been cheated on, wouldn't that sway?
Of course, that's one person that goes the other way. You know, you just right. don't. But the thing is that you would hope that, especially with a case like this, you've done a very thorough job in jury selection to be able to avoid anybody that has such a blatant propensity for having a bias, right? I mean, this is really, I mean, pregnant and having, I mean, that's pretty on point, you know?
Right.
You know, I would hope that that was never an issue. There were some jury issue. There was a jury issue, but it wasn't like this. I can't remember what the issue was. And one of the jurors from back in the day has now changed his tune and saying that for a long time he would go to media and say he's guilty of sin. And now he's like, well, maybe not, you know. But I don't remember. Oh, I know what the jury issue was in Peterson. So when you pick a jury in a death penalty case, the jury selection is far more stringent and entailed.
As it should be. Yeah.
And, one of the things is that the jurors have to be willing to impose death. So like I could never make it to a death penalty.
Me neither. Right. I mean, you could jury nullify, right? You could say, sure, I'd convict someone. And then when you get in the room being like, there's no fucking chance I'm ever going to convict this man to death. I'm fucking nullifying and I'm going to say not guilty.
Right. But in the selection process, if you
could lie,
you
can recommend it, but yes.
But if you tell the truth, you know, I mean, you are only qualified if you express a genuine ability that you can impose death. So there was an issue there where, the jury was biased in some way. And that's why the death penalty was set aside.
Taken off.
Later, and he was resentenced to life without parole. But listen, I think he has a really good chance because of the tremendous problems. This is not like one or two items that they're trying to test or retest. This is like things that were intentionally withheld. Because listen, if it's, I don't know, if it's some minor follow-up report of no significance, and there's like two of those or whatever, that's one thing. But the type of evidence that was not disclosed.
I mean, bloodstains on a van right by their place with a robbery happening. I mean, that's, to me, you don't got to be a rocket scientist to figure out the fucking, how the meat right. is made here. I mean,
the quantity and the quality of what was withheld.
Right.
I mean, pretty shady, you know, and that's exactly why we say somebody's wrongfully convicted. There was another big case that I think, the Innocence Project was behind. I know it was because my friend from the San Diego one was behind the exoneration. Brian Banks, are you familiar with that case?
Yeah. How do I know Brian Banks?
There was a movie about him.
Yes, and, that's right. Yes, there was that movie. Yes, I watched that movie. That's right.
You know, he was was on his way to a huge football career, and I think he was that's going right. to, and he was accused of rape. And then later the victim, I should say the accuser, recanted and even said why she lied. And he spent about, I think, 4 or 5 years behind bars, but completely lost his football career. I mean, lost his life.
I mean, it changed his life. I mean, that's the thing. When people sit behind prison for 30 years because you decided to lie 25 years ago, you don't get that shit back. I mean, that's why the Innocence Project needs to be here. For those people.
Yeah. And so Justin was saying that, you know, we typically don't take cases. What was it? Because he had already come out. I think he'd come out. Or what was it? I don't remember what it was, but it was something that they don't normally don't go after. But they felt so strongly about his case that they pursued it. I don't remember what it was, but it's an interesting case. And that was... That, you know, that was one of the more high profile ones. But like you said, a lot of the work they do is just low profile and under the radar. And they're funded by people like you and
right.
Public funding and private funding. And they're not going to mess with that. I mean, Scott Peterson is not buying his freedom. He's not paying the Innocence Project. He's not.
No. You know, and the IP has to prove that they're, I mean, you know, they always show their numbers, over 300 people exonerated based on DNA evidence that have been off of death row. You need to see that number to be like, fucking A, the United States almost murdered, you know, 300 fucking people willingly, legally based on that. I mean, that's crazy. And if it's your son, if it's your father, if it's your brother, if it's your boyfriend, if it's your wife, I think people need to take that into account. You have to pretend if it's you. And if it is you, you want the best teams going to be there. And I think the IP is like that. And police, I know that they do this sometimes, but can police lie to witnesses to manipulate them into testifying?
Well,
are police on, like, are they some sort of like code of conduct, or they're just trying to get anyone? I feel like they're just trying to hit their quota.
I love that thinking. they are, well, first of all, they are trained in interrogation tactics that one thing is, I think it dates back to the 40s, called the Reed technique. And that's straight up lying. I mean, that's straight up saying anything they need to say to elicit the statement they want, you know, and they put you in a cold room and they, you know, they don't give you, I mean, this, I'm talking about people they arrest, right?
But they could say, Sarah thinks you're a murderer, told us all night she thinks you're a murderer, Darren, she definitely thinks you're a murderer, even though you might not even know who I am. You might not have said that at all.
Exactly. And you're sitting there shivering and you want food and you're hungry and you're right. scared. And you might say things that you wouldn't otherwise say.
To get the fuck out of that position. Right.
That's completely, they get deference for that. We don't. I mean, if I send a PI to a witness and I really, really badly want them to say something, believe me, if my PI puts any pressure on that person and this makes its way to court,
you're out. That's tossed out in 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's I can not only can't get that in, but I might face some consequences myself. So Yes, they have a lot of leeway. They do lie. They do falsify reports. Not everyone, but some do. In Peterson's case, the witnesses that we're talking about right now are defense witnesses. So for the last almost 20 years, there were people that didn't give up on Scott. And one of them was a reporter who at the time worked for ABC and then was deployed to like Afghanistan or something, where he just left to do assignment. And then when he came back, he was like, I'm still not done with this. I'm going to go back to, you know, San Mateo, Modesto, whatever, that whole area. And I'm going to dig and dig and dig. And so there were people that didn't give up on him because they truly believed that he was wrongfully convicted. And so what we're seeing before the IP that led to the filing of these motions is the work product of 2 decades of investigation. And so with time, witnesses have come forward, they're more willing to talk. And so fuck the police and that up there. I mean, it's not about them anymore. It's about the defense witnesses, you know?
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see what they say.
Well, given the fact that you're really on the front lines of this, you're a lawyer, you know, ins and outs of a courtroom. And we're kind of wrapping up here. So I want to get to where Scott's going to be today and the next steps. But in your opinion, as a lawyer and also as a citizen, by the way, do lawyers sit on juries? Yes. You get called for jury duty. Yes.
I've never been picked.
Well, I wouldn't pick you either, sweetie. But I mean, but I was curious. You do get called.
Yeah,
serve. Okay.
Yeah.
I always tell people, because I've served on a jury before. It was a 4-day civil trial that happened in Manhattan court. And it happened when I was like 23, but it really gave me the insights to a courtroom. And I think that every single citizen should have to serve on a case. I think it's just, I think it makes you a better intellectual learner of how to take in this information. So for you from the lawyer side, who are talking to jurors all day long, what is the best way for people who are actually for justice, who want to be better citizens, who actually care about the truth and not just sort of feelings? How do we become better citizens with this stuff and become a better jury? I mean, what's something you think that we should be doing that maybe we're not really doing collectively as a society? Get the fuck off social media?
Yeah. I mean, even if you're not getting off, be careful about what you repost thoughtlessly and, you know, what you're agreeing with and just liking and all that, because, you know, you have to keep an open mind. You have to do your own investigation. I'm actually really pleasantly surprised at how informed people are that are not lawyers. You know, the crime fascination has always been there for,
sure.
for years. I can remember, but the public has never been so well informed. I mean, I'm talking to people that are like so well versed in my world, you know, the terms that they use, the procedure that they know. And it's because they're watching trials. They're not just reading about it or looking at reports, watching a courtroom with a high profile trial happening. And so I do think there's great benefit in that. What I don't like is that social media, it gives us the ability to just recklessly throw things out there that maybe we don't know yet and you know, endorse things and all that shit goes viral. And, you know, that's how we get to where the jury's poisoned.
I agree with that. I mean, certainly on Shaken to Disturbed, we're always like, if you're going to read the headline, click on the fucking article at least and read it, you know, because like the headlines are making you click on something and they're going to make you kind of like sway your opinion no matter what. And then when you read the article, you're like, wait a minute, but there isn't any evidence there to say that this man's guilty. They're just trying to get me to fucking click. So I always encourage people to actually read about these things and read a little bit further. One last question for you. What are the next steps with this case? When will we kind of see this retrial happen? What is the latest with Scott Peterson today that you know?
Yeah, so it was funny. I was talking to a reporter at News Nation yesterday about this. So there is a court date coming up this month, which is essentially procedural. It's about whether or not the defense has asked for some of their motions to be sealed. to protect the confidentiality of witnesses and identifying information. And so that's a very straightforward thing. The prosecution has responded to it. I don't know if they've objected to it. I can't imagine why they would. But anyway, that's going to get decided this month. I think it's about April 16th or so when he goes to court. By the way, he was given the option of coming to court in person, and one would think he would want to get on that bus because it's a really pretty road between him and the courthouse. But he said, "No, I'm going to just do it by Zoom." And then in May is the meat of this all, which is the motion. Which is the hearing on the motions to grant DNA testing, to grant retesting, to compel the prosecution to produce things. So that's all going to get heard in May. And then finally in June, it's been set for its setting. I'm not clear on what that is, but I believe that that might be a scheduling where they give the prosecution a certain amount of time to produce what, you know, what they're supposed to produce. And then they might from there set deadlines and things that both sides have to comply with. So, I mean, you have to think that even after the defense gets all these things, it takes a lot of time to retest and then go interview the people and, you know, do the investigation. This is, they, you know, discovery leads to more discovery. And right. So they need more things. And so this is going to be a process that to me is going to go on for at least 1 or 2 years before they can actually then file a habeas corpus writ for a new trial based on what they find out.
Would the same lawyers who were the prosecution last time, if alive and well and able and still practicing, be the same lawyers that are gonna possibly be in the retrial or no?
For the prosecution, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I hope the chick that slept with the cop, I mean.
Hope she's out. Yeah.
We don't got no booty calls this time around.
Yeah. Well, yeah, or not that we know. You know, discovery leads to more discovery, Sarah. It's been 20 years. We don't know.
I think that I'm sure that there'll be a motion to recuse based on that whole situation too. In terms of defense lawyers, though, remember the IP doesn't try cases.
Right.
So once they're able to get him exonerated, I mean, for sure, they're going to refile the case, I think. And once they do, Pat Harris, who was his lawyer with Mark Garagos at the time, is still sort of on the sidelines and remains on the docket. And so it sounds like he might step back in. And I think that Scott should have a strong female attorney. It just makes sense to me. I mean,
it would make sense. You want the woman there being like, this man,
right,
not killing his pregnant fucking wife. I'm a woman defending him. You know, I mean, yeah, you want that. Yes.
You've got the wife who is pregnant, who was cheated. I mean, you really, right. But you know, I work in a man's world. We were talking about how, that he would stay on, but he was like, I really think the case could benefit from a female too. So I don't know, you know?
Yeah, it's all about letting the facts lay where they may. Sarah, you are, I mean, I could literally talk to you for days. Like, I feel like we could argue and just go have a tete-a-tete all the time because you were just like a wealth of intellectual knowledge. And I really appreciate you taking the time. And I want you to plug your podcast and where people can find you, because I have a feeling people are going to be very interested after this to follow you.
The podcast is called The Presumption. We are on all the platforms where you listen to your podcast, so Apple, Spotify, etc. And we're on YouTube as well. And it's always at The Presumption. We should do like a regular, like little round table, like a 20-minute crimes of the week kind of, you know, breakdown.
I think we should too. I think we should. I think we would be good at that. I think we would be really good at that, you and me. I think we could do that and bring in some other people that I could argue with, because I'm always looking for people to argue with.
I don't think it necessarily needs to be crime. It could be like legal news of the week. And,
right.
You know, like just this week, it was like, you know, Diddy and Chad Daybell and, you know, so much happened.
So much. Yeah. So much. Sarah, you're the best. I love you. And everyone, definitely check out The Presumption. Thank you for listening to Shaken and Disturbed. John will be back next week in full force. And I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks, Sarah.